Welcome to the Decoding Crime and Culture podcast. This podcast explores deep into the intricate web of society, human behavior, and the systems that shape the world around us. We're your hosts, Mao and Jackie. As first-generation American-born millennial therapists, we're here to bring you a fresh perspective on the intersectionality of socio-political dynamics, culture, and crime.
In each episode, we'll navigate through the layers of stories that often remain hidden beneath the surface. We believe that by decoding the complex narratives that intertwine crime and culture, we can better understand the forces that influence our collective psyche. But we won't stop at individual stories. We'll zoom out to examine the larger tapestry, the historical context, the economic pressures, and the political climates that either nurture or challenge criminal behaviors.
We're here to decode it all. Join us on this journey as we unravel the mysteries, challenge assumptions, and provide insights that will spark thought-provoking conversations.
This is Decoding Crime and Culture. Get ready to see crime and culture through a new lens.
Welcome to Decoding Crime and Culture with Mao and Jackie. Today we have a really special episode that has been months in the making. I feel like more. Like, I think it's been a year.
I didn't want to put a year, but I'm pretty sure.
Not to be dramatic, but it's been years. We've been talking about doing an episode on the staircase, and today we're finally doing it. And no, it has been over a year because, Jackie, I think when I first had... No, not even when I had you on, when it was still Millennial Therapist podcast, but I think when we just chatted about true crime, immediately you're like, oh my gosh, staircase. And I was like, yes, it was definitely the owl.
Yep.
Solved. Done. But if you haven't heard of The Staircase, this is a true crime story that has captivated audiences for years, and literally years, because the case, Jackie will explain, but happened in 2001. This case has been featured on Forensic Files, has been the subject of a Netflix documentary that has won awards, by the way, and most recently an HBO Max drama. And today we're going to focus on the facts and give you our thoughts on this case, even if you didn't ask for it.
So for some background, on December 9th, 2001, novelist Michael Peterson called 911 to report that his wife Kathleen had fallen down the stairs and died. Peterson claimed that he had been outside by the pool, and when he came back inside, he found his wife at the bottom of the staircase. As the investigation unfolded, questions arose about the true cause of Kathleen's death. The prosecution argued that Peterson had killed his wife and that the fall down the stairs was staged to make it look like an accident. They pointed to the fact that there was a large amount of blood at the scene and that there were lacerations on Kathleen's head that were inconsistent with a fall. The defense, on the other hand, argued that Kathleen's death was a tragic accident. They pointed to the fact that Peterson had no history of violence and that there was no evidence of a struggle. They suggested that Kathleen may have fallen down the stairs after consuming alcohol and Valium. We're going to talk a little bit about the blood alcohol level and everything that was found. So the case ultimately went to trial, and after a lengthy legal battle, Peterson was convicted of murdering his wife and sentenced to life in prison. However, in 2011, new evidence came to light that cast doubt on Peterson's guilt. The case was reopened, and after a new trial, Peterson entered an Alford plea to voluntary manslaughter, allowing him to maintain his innocence while acknowledging that there was enough evidence to convict him. The case of the staircase remains controversial to this day. It raises really important questions about the criminal justice system, the role of forensic evidence in trials, and the difficulty of determining the truth in complex cases.
Yes. And if you want a deep, deep, deep dive, we definitely recommend the Netflix series on this case. Yeah, it's done really well. So the director is a French documentary creator, and he actually won an award for the before for another true crime documentary series. I want to say it's called something, I forget the title, something something Sunday, I think. Don't quote me on it. I'll make sure we have it in the description. But essentially, it showed a poor black defendant navigating the U.S. legal system. And he also won awards for that one. And so this director, I think, caught wind of what was happening with Michael Peterson and asked if he could be part of this. So the lawyer, what's his name? Rudolph, obviously greenlit the project. So that's how we got to see close proximity of everything. So deep dive there. You're not going to get all of it here. We have an hour.
There's just too much. And that's something that we had talked about when we were getting ready for this podcast. Like, there is just too much to dig into. Right. Like, even just the documentary series on Netflix, it's 10 episodes. It's like an hour, hour and a half each episode. Yeah. And it is showing you everything. Like, it's so interesting because you very rarely get to see a case from its inception, from like...
Yeah.
Happens through like litigation, through the trial process, jury, mm-hmm. and interviewing the expert witnesses, doing all that stuff, and then eventually to sentencing, and then after what happens. So it's really fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and I appreciate that Rudolph, I think it was Rudolph that mentioned it, or maybe the interviewer that had mentioned that following Michael Peterson's case was showing what it looked like to have money in the legal system. Because as I was watching it, I didn't know any of that. And I was like, oh, this is privileged as fuck. Because yeah. Michael Peterson had the money to pay, I think it was like $30,000 to do a panel of, mm-hmm. it's almost like a, you know, when you're marketing
group.
Yeah, a focus group. And I was like, what? Like, it makes sense, but wow. And then they're like, oh, it's like $30,000. And Michael Peterson, again, we'll talk about it, but I like him. And I don't want it to be true. He is very likable. He's very socially just, which is also hard, too, because he even said, like, the legal system's fucked and I have money. He's like, can you imagine somebody being poor and going through this? You're not going to win. So yeah. I do appreciate that privilege, but also lots of complexities. And I think that's going to be the common theme that Jackie and I will continue to say is this shit's complex, right? And I think we want to make it a little more digestible for all of us. So I've gone on and on about Michael Peterson. So who is Michael Peterson and his late wife, Kathleen? On paper, they seem like a perfect couple. They got together in 1987, then married in 1997, and remained married until her death, 2001. They both had been married before and brought to the relationship several adult children. So he had two biological sons, his two adopted daughters, and then her daughter. Both Kathleen and Michael were extremely accomplished people. Kathleen was a VP at Nortel Networks, which is like a communication company, right?
Yeah.
And she was the first woman to be accepted to the School of Engineering at Duke University, which is phenomenal. Michael was a Vietnam veteran and a New York Times best-selling author, as well as a local newspaper columnist. Wow, that's a hard word. He wrote for the local newspaper.
There you go.
From my understanding, too, he was pretty unbiased in like what he also wrote about. He, I think, tried to be very objective when he reported mm-hmm. on things. And he mentioned how the town and the community did not care for him because of that, which I think plays into also, you know, his court case and stuff. If we look objectively and not like if he really did it or not. So then in 1999, Michael ran for mayor of their hometown, Durham, North Carolina, and he did not win, from my understanding. And during that time, he had claimed that he had been awarded a Silver Star, Bronze Star with Valor, and two Purple Hearts. It was reported he had the medals, but no documentation. And during this mayoral race, it was uncovered that he did not have the Purple Hearts. it was confirmed that he did have the Silver Star, Bronze Star. Mm-hmm. But the Purple Hearts he did not get. And for the folks that aren't in the military, you get a Purple Heart for being injured in combat. And so he had claimed that he was, I want to say, like, hit by shrapnel during a mortar in Vietnam. He was shot at. He was injured in the service, but it was when he was in Japan, and it was by a really bad car accident that a fellow Marine had died during that accident. So it's still traumatic, but not combat related. Mm-hmm. So of course that comes to question of character, to be lying about a Purple Heart. And I mean, does that make him a killer? No. But I think it just adds another layer of, like, why are you lying? And yeah. I don't know, people lie all the time about shit like that. So I mean, I might be biased. Maybe I watched the documentary too much, but I'm not going to hold that against him. I don't think he's a fucking sociopath or anything, if we're going to talk about that. But, yeah. I mean, yeah, I know there are worse things, in my opinion, than lying about Purple Heart. You don't get money for having a Purple Heart. So I think he just wanted the credibility and also... I think his books that he wrote were, like, military related. So again, he wanted credibility for that. So that's all I got regarding that. But here are some facts of the night in question. So on December 9th, 2001, he had called 911 and reported that he had found her at the bottom of the stairs. And you can hear the recording. It's available public. He sounds...
It's gut-wrenching.
Yeah, like, he sounds very distraught and, like, yes. So what essentially he had said was they were watching a Julia Roberts movie outside, or they had been watching it and then they went outside to have some drinks and were chatting by the pool. But it was later determined that Kathleen had sent an email an hour prior to this time. And Michael reported he stayed outside smoking his pipe as she went upstairs to work. And then he went in 45 minutes later where he had found her in the bottom of the stairs. And he had called 911 at 2:40 a.m., called twice to make sure that the paramedics were on the way. She was pronounced dead on the scene. She had a blood alcohol level of 0.07 and was found with microscopic feathers in her hair that were in her hands. That's interesting.
we're gonna talk a little bit. So that's not something that was really brought up a lot during the trial, unfortunately. But the prosecution did have a couple of really key arguments that they had focused in on during the trial, and one of them being the crime scene. At the heart of the prosecution's case was the assertion that the crime scene showed signs of foul play. Like, the way they described it is that it was one of the bloodiest scenes that they had ever seen throughout, like, their history. I think Deborah Radish, the associate chief medical examiner, I want to get her title correct, had made a couple of statements regarding that. And other, you know, paramedics, people who approached or who responded at the scene, had made comments about it being really very, very, very graphic. And they argued that, or the prosecution at least argued that the blood spatter on the walls, the pool of blood at the bottom of the staircase, the lacerations on Kathleen's head did not align with the defense's narrative of a fall. Prosecution stated that deaths due to falling down the stairs were uncommon, and the associate chief medical examiner, Deborah Radish, reported that she had not seen anything like this throughout her entire career. As a quick aside, my abuelo would always say that, this is so ridiculous, he would say that older adults always die of three things, and it's catarro, caídos, and oh my gosh, I forgot the last one, but it's very like, and cagazón, which translates to colds, falls, and shits. I always say that.
That's amazing. But
yeah, so falls can be deadly. I think that it's a little bit ridiculous to paint with such a broad brush that falls cannot, like, hurt. But they were
people
like,
die from falls all the time. What the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah. But falling down the stairs, it's not I don't know. Like,
did you see them stairs, though? They looked hard as fuck.
Yeah. And imagine being, like, a little tipsy and going up those stairs. You know, it just doesn't seem like... and taking Valium as well.
Yeah. And drunk.
Yeah. With any type of controlled substance like that, like, it's going to add to the effect. Well, like, that is going to be multiplied by imbibing alcohol.
Right.
Or using the other controlled substance, like mixing things like that. So, like, all of these medications that tell you don't drink while you're
exactly taking. And Valium, from my understanding, is a benzo, is it not?
I think it is, yeah.
Let me double check. It's a diazepam. So it is a benzo, so that shit is strong.
Yeah, no, you can't, you cannot play with that. So
hell no,
that's just a personal aside. So upon examining Kathleen's body, Deborah Radish also reported the presence of red neurons, which she said in forensic files, which is how I initially got interested in this case. In the forensic files, she said that was like the smoking gun, in essence, like it, for the whole case. Having the presence of red neurons when they were examining her indicates that the person has had an episode of lack of oxygen. And she said, quote, 2-6 hours before death. So she's saying that Kathleen did not have sufficient oxygen for 2-6 hours before she died.
And maybe, and did she mention like what that would be in addition to alcohol, which is a downer?
Yeah.
Also, which makes me think it makes it harder for people to walk upstairs or come down the stairs when you don't have enough oxygen in your system.
No, absolutely. And, you know, she conveniently left that out in the relationship to... she conveniently left out on the forensic files her being under the influence of alcohol and a benzo. But she did mention that piece. The forensic files, if you haven't seen that particular episode, it's called A Novel Idea. I believe it's season 6, episode 22.
just so y'all know, she remembered that on the top of her head. There are no notes.
No, I don't have that. That's not in my notes. Just in case, because we did see, I watched it with my husband recently.
Oh, yeah.
Loves Forensic Files. And there, that particular episode never felt like this one about this particular case about the staircase never felt like right.
Right.
Like,
there's so much more. And also, do we need to have your husband on the show?
Maybe. I think he would love that. But should we do that? Should we just have both our partners on the show one
day? Yeah. Like, I have to have a stand-in because my partner's so shy.
Oh, my God.
Like, I mean, he's a therapist and blah, blah, blah. But, like, he just doesn't like, one, hearing himself, and two, like, he's not natural in front of things that are recording. So he's, like, too self-conscious. But he's fun. God. But whatever. I'm going to have a stand-in. Bring your boo.
I'll bring my boo. Another
so times. Is Dr. Deborah then on whose side? Prosecutor? So,
prosecutor.
Oh, hell no.
Yeah, Dr. Deborah was prosecutor. I feel like Dr. Deborah, and we're going to get into this in a little bit, I feel like she's one of the people who examined Elizabeth Ratliff and determined that it was a homicide. I'm not 100% sure. Don't quote me on that one, but I have a feeling that she did. So
you're right, because in the Netflix series, that was one of the earlier ones. So really quickly, I think that's helpful to tie back, is Elizabeth was a friend of Michael and Patty or Kathleen? Patty, right? Yeah, when they lived in Germany, and Elizabeth suffered also a fall and died from that. So prosecution found out and had her body exhumed. And instead of having her body examined and autopsied by someone in North Carolina, they sent the body to someone in Texas. And that's where Jackie is saying it might have been Deborah, Dr. Deborah, because I remember Michael's lawyer was pissed. And Michael, of course, was like, why the fuck would they spend thousands of dollars sending her body to Texas to somebody that was already biased about it?
It wasn't Dr. Deborah, because she was the associate chief medical examiner in Durham.
Okay, so she was in Durham. Okay, so maybe so somebody else that the prosecution had. So I apologize. Please don't sue me, allegedly, Deborah. we're besties. You're amazing. Speaks to how biased this process is because they had her body, Elizabeth's body, examined by somebody on the prosecution team.
Yeah. And Elizabeth died of a brain hemorrhage, according to the German authorities. And even after everything was revised with the new medical exam or the new autopsy in the U.S., the German authorities denied it was homicide.
Yeah.
They refused to sign on to that. And the prosecution used this whole thing as part of their argument. Yep. And they wanted to show that this was a pattern of behavior. Like, oh, it's not just one woman.
It's two.
Around Michael. It's two women end up dead at the bottom of the stairs.
And can I say that this bitch prosecutor, I'm sorry.
Oh, my
gosh.
She had
the nerve to be like, to the jury, and so condescendingly was like, are you going to sit here and tell me you believe that lightning strikes twice? A bitch, it does. You fucking idiot. It's called science. The Empire State Building has been struck many times. Like, so I was like, oh, what the hell? Yeah, so I had to air that out because I'm like, you are so dumb right now.
She was the worst. The worst. Oh my gosh. Just like the attitude. Yeah. Margot Posey does such a good job. Have you seen the show?
I have not. Not the drama.
You would love it now. Like, really, it's really excellent. I think that it's pretty faithful to the documentary. Mm-hmm. Some things that are kind of, what's the word, that are dramatized. Yeah. Of course, because it's a documentary on, or excuse me, it's a drama on HBO. Right. So, of course, like that. But I think that it was very faithful to the original material. Michael Peterson refuses to watch it.
I know, I saw that. His family refuses to watch it also, which I see why.
I would not want to be re-traumatized either. Sure. Let's talk a little bit more about the prosecution and what they said. So we talked about the prior incident. We talked about the actual crime scene. Let's talk about the blood spatter, because the blood spatter was a wild ass situation. The prosecution called on expert witnesses, quote unquote, which were later debunked, to testify that the blood spatter at the scene indicated a violent struggle and an accidental fall. They argued that the blood patterns suggested an attack, possibly with a blunt object, allegedly a blowpoke, which is an instrument used in fireplaces. There was reported to be congealed blood on the wall of the staircase, smeared blood that the prosecution alleged someone had tried to clean up, and blood on the bottom of Kathleen's feet. Blood drops were found outside on the back patio, and there was also a blood stain on the back door. So there was finally a bloody shoe print on the bottom of Kathleen's pants, which matched Michael's shoes. So we know that blood spatter analysis is a bullshit thing. It's like complete pseudoscience. I think we talk about that a little bit later about we do a little bit of a deeper dive into Dwayne Deaver and what a fucking great guy he is. Yeah, right. No.
Psych. He's sarcasm. Fuck that dude. Fuck you, Dwayne.
The worst. So we have a couple of things working against Michael, and then there's also his behavior. Prosecutors highlighted that his behavior after the incident was not really consistent with somebody whose wife had just tragically died. And they pointed out that he seemed strangely calm and composed for a husband who had just discovered his wife's lifeless body at the foot of the stairs. So something that these people don't really take into account is trauma responses. Yeah,
like, I don't know, biology?
Yeah.
Wild.
And people freeze or people shut down. People just kind of respond to loss and to these very traumatic events in a multitude of different ways.
Mm-hmm. And it's such a catch-22 of, like, you're freaking out too much so it looks fake, or you're not freaking out enough. So honestly, like, there's no perfect way to react. When I was listening to that and, like, thinking about, like, what would my husband, how he would respond, he would probably faint, you know, like, and then be completely blank because he's dissociating.
Yeah.
You know, like, and how would I? I would probably be freaking out, then dissociating, because that's my trauma response, is I just go into tunnel vision and shut down completely. So, yeah, I think that is such a poor argument nowadays.
Yeah. Unfortunately, most courts are not trauma-informed.
Yeah, yeah.
This one, Durham, North Carolina in 2001.
For sure.
Not trauma-informed at all. So there was his behavior, and there was also a financial motive. Prosecutors also raised the idea of Michael's mounting financial debts and suggested that Kathleen's life insurance policy might have been a motive for a murder. It was alleged that Michael had not made money in approximately 2 years before Kathleen's death. Due to this, it was also alleged that the couple was in $243,000 in credit card debt. It was also alleged that Kathleen's company stock, which was once worth $2.5 million, was now worth less than $50,000. Huge hit. It was also discovered that Michael was the beneficiary of Kathleen's $2 million life insurance policy. Something that I didn't mention here that I think might be important as well, because at one point, one of Michael's sons was considered one of the suspects. And Kathleen was, and Michael were supporting his adult sons.
Yeah. That's a good point.
And they had three daughters in college.
Yeah, that's a really good point too, that I don't think they mentioned much. I didn't hear much of the financial piece in the documentary. Do you remember? Yeah.
I don't remember. It's been a minute, to be honest with you. But they really went in on it on Forensic Files.
You know what? When I watched the Forensic Files, I was like, oh, he absolutely did it. Like, because of those motives. But motives are just kind of hypotheses too, right? Motives are it doesn't, literally the smoking gun, right? Like, sure. Like, you can find motive in lots of things. But when you do have motive, it does give you more of an incentive to see why they're guilty.
No, absolutely. So there's also the sex thing.
Yeah.
Put it like that.
Oh, you mean the gay thing too?
Yeah.
We're laughing because it's so ridiculous. It's
so absurd. But this is, again, you know, like, we have to remember that 2001, in essence.
In North Kakalaki, yeah.
No disrespect if you're tuning in from North Carolina. Like, it's the South, you know, even from the North, like, where we're from, like, you from Massachusetts, New Jersey, in 2001, like, I'm thinking back in high school, like,
oh, so anti-gay still.
Even from, like, the late 2000s, that did not age well.
Yeah.
And would not, like, that shit would not be allowed today.
For sure.
You know, it's just not, it's just a little ridiculous. But the prosecutors held on to this shit. Like, they really zeroed in on his sexuality. And your best friend forever, Frida Black, actually had gone and she
wait, is that the prosecutor?
Yeah, that's her. Your BFF. Your BFF. She said it was pure tea filth.
Ew. You
believe what was found on his computer. Pure tea filth. Like, she was, this is my very poor Southern accent, North Carolina accent. But she was, like, she really trying to paint a picture of him as, like, a sexual deviant and a predator. This all came out because there were some emails that were uncovered between Michael and between a male sex worker talking about meeting up for a rendezvous. And they never met up.
but they were just kind of talking about, and he said, you know, I love my wife, but I'm very bi, were his exact words. And he also reported that he had no intention of meeting the guy. Like, it could just be kind of like, I don't even want to call it like a sneaky link. It's like the
situation. Just like just the communication itself.
Kind of like a little, you know, like a little flirt, like flirtation type of thing, but not actually. Like, there's a lot of, and granted, you know, when we think about it, if we think about like couples work, which I know is not your favorite, Mal, like you don't, you know, like couples work is fucking hard.
Yeah, my nervous system is not stable enough for that.
You know what it is? I can't watch two people devolve like that. Like,
I feel triangulated even though I'm the therapist. Like, if it's just your job, I'm like, oh, no. I don't want to be part of this.
But yeah, it's considered cheating.
I think what they pushed so hard to, though, as the prosecution, not only that, oh, he was having affairs or whatever, that, but he was gay, like that he killed her because he was bisexual. Yeah. And Michael, and I don't know how much truth is, I didn't hear any corroboration for this, but he's like, she knew I was bisexual.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, it's not a big deal. His friends was like, oh, I've been knew he was bisexual since we were like 13. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
So yeah, I feel like for me, like that didn't hold much motive for him to, like, superficially was like, oh yeah, it makes sense why he like kind of, you know, went off the rails and attacked her because she found an email and blah, blah, blah. But that was really the picture that the prosecution painted. It didn't seem like it was truth. The interesting thing is, though, if you watch the Netflix documentary and you watch the one episode, I want to say it's maybe the second or third one, where you actually watch him practicing how to be the perfect defendant, essentially. He's getting coached by a person, like his lawyer, and I forget who this, like, he's a consultant. He was really helping him. He knew his shit. And he was, so they were asking him questions, like real ass heavy hitter questions. And it was like, did you have an affair? He's like, no, define affair. He's like, no. He's like, sex. He's like, oh yeah, I had sex while we were with other people while we were married. So like, as much as we've been like kind of, you know, rooting for Michael of like, there's not enough, like, he did cheat on her multiple times. I don't think it was an open relationship, right?
Ask you that. Do you think that the relationship was a little open?
It didn't seem like it. I think he would, if it was, I think he would have absolutely said, like, she knew about it, or, you know, it was open. But I don't think it was. It made it seem like, and this is just my speculation, that he did it, maybe she found out and didn't love it, but didn't oppose it, if that makes sense. Or that she wasn't going to, like, not be married to him.
Yeah, like, it wasn't enough for her to leave the marriage.
Right. Like, it was something that she, like, I hate to say it, but, like, learned to live with.
Yeah.
So, again, different from open and polyamorous, because I don't think she consented to it. I think he was just doing it.
Yeah.
So it was, like, non-consensual polyamory on one-sided, essentially. So, yes, was that a perfect marriage? No. But was that enough for murder? I don't think so.
No.
From that, anyways. Also, he had a thing for military men, though. That was also talked about. He loved him some military men. Because they be gay, too. Yeah, so the prosecution had a lot, but what they didn't have was, to make it solid, was DNA. They only found Kathleen's DNA in the blood, in the hair, at the scene of the crime. There was no murder weapon. They believe that the blow poke was the murder weapon, but it was never recovered, despite multiple searches of the home. And they didn't have credible expert witnesses. They consulted a forensic meteorologist. Wait, what?
Yeah, bro. Like, it's so stupid.
What is a forensic meteorologist? I had to read.
So it's absolutely preposterous. What the forensic meteorologist does, the way I understand it, is they look at the weather. They look at the weather on the day in the location to see whether or not certain garments would have been appropriate for the, like, because, okay, so he was wearing shorts and a t-shirt And in North Carolina, the temperature was like 50 some odd degrees or so. So they used this guy talking about the weather fucking report, being like, why is he there? And how could he be outside in shorts and a t-shirt for an hour? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Because he was drunk. Drunk people be outside cold all the time.
Yeah.
That's stupid. So you're right. What they didn't have was credible expert witnesses. No,
they didn't. They didn't.
And they definitely didn't have a blood splatter expert, because homeboy, well, one, just blood splatter expertise has been proven to be found as junk science, right?
Yeah.
Very subjective. And two, the homie that they had, who was the one that examined the shorts of Michael Peterson and made thousands of attempts to eventually match the shorts and the blood spatter of the staircase, he was trying to meet the results. Like, how unbiased is that? And also, he made up his credentials. He falsified his expertise. And he also, I think, fabricated a lot of other results too, which then threw out dozens of other trials, conviction, and he was eventually fired, but no criminal, what do you call it, criminal consequences, from my understanding. I want to find a little more. I didn't,
which is ridiculous. Like, Duane Deaver should have been prosecuted because he, like, he perjured himself.
Yeah
throughout just that trial alone, you know.
I think it's important to know, like, how important his testimony was to the conviction of Michael Peterson. So Michael Peterson was essentially found guilty. Due to his falsified credentials, dozens of other trials botched. He was later fired. And eventually in October 2003, Michael Peterson was found guilty of murder and was sentenced to life in prison without parole. While in prison, there were two appeals filed, which were both denied. And then in 2008, Michael's new attorneys filed a motion for a new trial because of Duane Deaver's qualifications being disputed, an allegation that the prosecution withheld exculpatory evidence, and an allegation that one juror bases judgment on racial factors. What was that? Do we know that racial factor piece?
I don't know enough about this situation, to be honest with you. I feel like the documentary goes into it a little bit more. But yeah, that was one of the allegations that they had. But the two biggest factors were Duane Deaver's qualifications being bullshit, and that the prosecution withheld evidence that could have been exculpatory.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So after 8 years in prison, in 2011, the conviction was overturned and a new trial was set. But then in 2017, Michael was offered a plea deal called an Alford plea, in which he had to admit to voluntary manslaughter. He reported during an interview the Alford plea was to acknowledge that there was enough evidence to convict, but I'm innocent. So he took it, obviously, and he then is found guilty of voluntary manslaughter, and he walked. Well, you know, he didn't serve more time because of the time served during that 8 years. And in an interview with 60 Minutes Australia, Michael stated why he participated in the documentary. He said, "I did not trust the judicial system in Durham, and I did not trust the police for that matter." And I did not trust the police for that matter in particular, and I wanted it documented completely. And I really did not give any thought to the fact that, oh, hundreds and now millions of people will see this and judge me.
Which he's totally right. Not trusting these. Look at all the shit that this man had to go through.
For sure.
You know, regardless of what you think, whether or not he did it or not, like, it just... You know, like you were saying before, Mal, like, this is there were wealthy people. They were wealthy people, and they had to navigate the American legal system, and it was just a shit show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it shows us how the prosecution side actually works too, that they are hellbent on creating a narrative. And I think that shows how innocent people absolutely get convicted, right? Or they end up pleading because they feel like their hands are tied because prosecution has all these resources, and that's the state's money. That is our taxpayers' money, right? Essentially, that goes into that shit. So I think that will be interesting to see that part, is like the prosecutors are not always the good guys, you know, especially if you're on the defendant side, right? And that made me realize how fucked the legal system is when I was seeing cases like Ahned, I'm so sorry, but one of the first podcast series, Ahned, Making Him the Murderer, which actually happened in Wisconsin, not that far from me. Wild. I know. In Appleton, Wisconsin. And we're not looking at did he do it, did he not, but was there enough evidence, right? Because again, if we sit with we're innocent until proven guilty, yes, that means you have to have enough evidence to find me guilty, but that's not the case. That is objectively not what's happening. And I think the staircase is another example of that.
Absolutely. 1,000%. It's just, it's so frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Because we both like work within the system, and everybody we know and our clients included are affected by this. And it's just, I think that those three cases in particular, with Adnan Syed, with Stephen Avery.
Yes.
And with Michael Peterson, it's just like all, you know, it like, anything can happen to anybody, pretty much.
Yeah, that's what got me hella scared, and also recognizing, like, hold up, these systems are not for us.
No, they're not.
You're Black, brown, indigenous, poor, like, good luck. And I'm many of those. At least 2 out of 3 or 4. We're not in the top 1%, because look at fucking Michael Peterson had mad money, or at least money to put into this, and still was found guilty in the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, it's so funny. Like, I remember when I was in graduate school, we were talking about power and privilege and like kind of is broken down. And the professor really interestingly put it like a bingo game almost, or like, if you are queer, okay, like you lose a piece.
Right.
If you are born female, like you lose a piece. If you're an immigrant, you lose a piece. And like all these different things. If you have some type learning challenge.
Right. Disable. Goodbye.
Like all this stuff kind of removes like from your privilege.
Right.
You know, in this case, like him being, he didn't call himself queer, but he called himself bi, him being totally removed.
Yeah.
A lot of
absolutely
privilege that he had, you know, it sucks. So this whole case was a shit show. And to complicate this a little bit further, there was an additional part of this shit show, and it would be remiss of me if I did not share the owl theory. So Larry Pollard, a former attorney and special prosecutor and the Petersons' neighbor, reported, "I was interested in finding the truth and finding justice. I started looking into it because we have owls in the neighborhood and the woods, and I was shown leads. And what I was shown leads me to think something else happened, and I really came to the conclusion this was an attack by a wild bird, not prey outside, I repeat, outside of her residence." Just as an FYI, he now believes that the attack happened. According to Reddit, he now believes that the attack happened indoors, that the owl followed her. The owl kind of like got her outside and then followed her into the home.
Oh, I see.
He wrote something for a legal journal recently, writing about it, because the man is legitimately an attorney. So like,
He's not some like,
this isn't some
psychotic dude.
A sign in the corner. It's like wild shit. This is like
he an reads.
Attorney and a special prosecutor who was close to the family and was familiar with like how they interacted with each other and that type of stuff. So microscopic feather fragments were wrapped around Kathleen's hair, which was found in her hands. And they were recovered but never followed up on by the prosecution or by the medical examiners. It was also believed that the wounds on the back of Kathleen's head were consistent with an owl's talons. Like the three, it kind of looked like that. And if you compare the wounds for Elizabeth Ratliff in from her fall following the brain hemorrhage, they're completely different. They look different than Kathleen's. There's some that it does look like they're scratches. And granted, we're not experts here, but
which leads to the blood. So much blood, because that was also the defense spoke to, just like that's where a lot of blood, like we when we have head injuries and all that stuff, like there's a lot of, what do you call it, capillaries and all that blood vessels there too.
Absolutely. Like your head and your legs, like your thighs,
right?
Very dangerous places to get cut, because
absolutely
so much blood that can come out of there.
Yep.
So Netflix didn't include this in the original documentary, but they added like a special thing.
Yep.
And so from the Netflix special episode edition or supplement or whatever, they spoke with Dr. Alan Van Norman, who is a neurosurgeon and an ornithology expert. And he stated, it should be mentioned that barred owls, which are the owls that are
in the area,
are known to owl experts to attack people out of the blue, unprovoked, with no warning. So the fact that Kathleen lived in a place where these owls are prevalent and that she got whacked in the head by one is not out of the ordinary. Like, I remember when we first started talking about this, Mel, a year ago. I said, bro, it was the owl. The owl did it. It was totally an owl that fucking did it. But you know, after looking at all of this and, you know, like we said before, we could really go on a deep dive here with the, we could do a whole season on the staircase alone.
Yeah.
You know, I still kind of think it was the owl, and I'm an
Me too. Okay. Well, here we are, bitch. It was the owl, Michael Peterson.
And it's not because he's charismatic. It's when you look at
the evidence.
When you look at the
evidence. And the lack of evidence. There's no DNA. I literally just Googled to add, and then on Reddit, it was like, why he not have blood on him if he did it?
Yeah.
I'm like, that's a good ass question. Where was the blood? If he, there was so much blood splatter all around, where is the blood? And they did not find it if he even changed, right? If he had murdered her, got bloody, I don't think there was enough time for him to had cleaned up or changed, because they would have seen the luminol in the bathroom, blah blah blah, if they even did that. So like Reddit asked the question, why he don't have the blood on him? If he did it.
What is it?
I'm gonna find this Reddit person. I was like, damn, lawyer.
There's a wild ass Reddit that is in there that is out of control, and has all of these, like, they do really, really deep dives into this.
And listen, Reddit be solving crimes too, so don't sleep on the Reddit.
Mm-mm.
In conclusion, it was the owl. I mean, in the beginning, I don't know if it was on recording, but I was like, you know what, I think Michael did it, but you know what, I don't think so anymore.
You know, it's just, it's
per the evidence.
If we look at it objectively, there's not enough evidence to convict here. If I was a juror.
Right. So even with the Alfred, that's why it was confusing. And, you know, that could be another conversation. But even with the Alfred plea, it says there is enough evidence to convict. But I'm not saying I did it. But it's like, is there, though? Is there even enough evidence to convict?
I don't think so.
I think the courts gave that so they don't have to also go into a trial and him get acquitted.
Yeah, it was to just wrap that shit up.
Exactly, because they knew they didn't have it in them. And I think he was also tired too. He was like, I already did my time. Make sure I don't spend more time. So, friends, that was a wild ass ride. Thank you for holding on. This has been another episode of Decoding Crime and Culture with Mao and Jackie. If you have any suggestions for other episodes or future episodes, or want to learn more about a specific case, please let us know. We're at Decoding Crime and Culture on Instagram. It'll be linked if you remember that, or if I said it wrong, I probably did. So until next time, stay curious and stay safe. Bye.
Bye.